You're listening to the Washington Hospitality Industry Podcast, your primary source of information related to the hospitality industry in Washington State.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Today, we are talking key factors impacting the value of a hospitality business at the time of sale with our good friend, Oliver Kotelnikoff from IBA. Just a little bit of housekeeping before we get started. Yes, we are recording this webinar, and it will be up online first thing tomorrow morning, along with his presentation slide, if you want that too. We also have a number of other webinars coming up next week. We are hearing from the folks at Tip House at 10 a.m. on May 15th. And on May 22nd, we have our friends from Parker Smith and Feek talking about what you can do about crime in your neighborhood. And that will be at 10 a.m. on May 22nd. And you can register for both of those on our website. That's wahospitality.org. And now today we have Oliver and we have Ken Wells, the Washington Hospitality Association's Director of Business Development. And good morning.
Good morning. And I just want to briefly say thank you for attending. Oliver is a great partner of the association, one of our professional vendors and professionals that support services. And he has got a long history of being in the hospitality industry. So he comes from a family of hospitality business owners. So he understands what he does. He's now a professional and has been for a couple of decades in helping people prepare their businesses for sale. So with that, Oliver, I'm gonna turn it over to you for the beginning of this and get this thing started. And it's in your hands now.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Washington Hospitality Association. Pleasure to be here once again. And before we get started, so this webinar is a little bit of a different format than the free-flowing discussion that we normally engage in. It will be based in PowerPoint. It's not my intention to bring about a total eclipse of the brain or sudden death or long and prolonged death by PowerPoint, but PowerPoint is here to, the slides are here to keep us on track and hopefully make things clear and get the concepts across. And the topic, I would say, is one that's certainly on the agenda by popular demand, demystifying the revenue multiple. And so we've got quite a bit of grid material. If there are questions, I'd be happy to, if we have time at the end, Q&A will be great. If not, happy to field those directly, and my information will be put up by the association, and I'll also show it on towards the end. So let's just get started. Key factors impacting the value of a hospitality business at the time of sale, demystifying the revenue multiple. So agenda, we're going to talk about the basic valuation formula. We're going to talk about key factors of the equation. We'll chat about the role of ownership, probably one of the overlooked factors in evaluations, how we calculate fair market value, and a fun little section at the end called Mythbusters. So diving right in, fundamental equation. So in that question that business owners often ask and that I'm approached with is, what is my revenue multiple? So in that question itself, there are two factors. So revenue, we'll call it factor A. We're multiplying that by the multiple, we'll call that factor B. And that will get us to goodwill, blue sky value of the business. And we'll touch more on the definition of goodwill later in the presentation. But first and foremost, how do we determine these factors? What is revenue? What is multiple? How do we assign values to them? So we'll start with factor A, revenue. What is revenue? And this is a little bit of multiple choice here. Is it gross sales or your top line revenue? Is it annual income plus the fair market value of equipment inventory and leasehold improvements? Is it potential future earnings of the business, or is it documented present day and historical profitability adjusted for discretionary and non-recurring expenses? So answer A, gross sales, top line revenue, it's not that, because no matter how much we bring in as gross revenue, we need to know how much of that is falling to the bottom line. Annual income plus fair market value of equipment inventory and leasehold improvements. So annual income, income is a often a confusing and a large umbrella category. It can mean many different things. So we stay away from using that term without further definition. And then the fair market value of equipment and inventory and leasehold improvements, it's factored in the evaluations, but it's not part of revenue. So potential future earnings of the business, it is not that, because it's really difficult to quantify potential future earnings simply because the future has not happened yet. We're in the present, and we can talk about the past, and we can draw a line to a near future time period, but we can't really take a view of here's what the business is capable of doing in the next 20 years. And then it is answer D, so documented present day and historical profitability, and notice it says profitability, not revenue or income, adjusted for discretionary and non-recurring expenses. So documented profitability, and here comes the keyword adjusted. So what does it mean to adjust profitability, and how do we do it? Some common terms that you may have seen. So EBITDA, SDE, seller discretionary earnings, adjusted cash flow, they are used interchangeably with a slight variance in definition depending on who you ask. But EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. SDE is seller's discretionary earnings. Adjusted cash flow is adjusted profitability. But really what we're trying to get to is this concept of net profitability, meaning what is the business capable of generating to an owner operator or an investor? How do we go about adjustments? So if we just take reported profitability from your tax return, what do we do to adjust the bottom line to actually reflect the true earning power of the business? So common addbacks and adjustments to reported profitability. So part of that's going to be in the definition of EBITDA that we just read, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So let's look at some of those things. Compensation and benefits of ownership. So what you take as W-2 wages, what owners pay themselves, and their medical benefits, retirement benefits, et cetera, those are all forms of compensation of ownership. They're not compensation. What you pay yourself isn't always directly correlated to your fair market replacement cost. It's not correlated to what you actually do in the business. So for purposes of generating an adjusted cash flow figure, compensation and benefits of ownership are added back. And by added back, and or adjusting, I'm using those interchangeably, those improve profitability. They take expenses and remove them, therefore boosting the bottom line. So tangible and intangible asset write-offs, depreciation and amortization. So we commonly see this, and you'll see this most likely on your tax returns. Depreciation is a way of capitalizing the expenses associated with purchases of tangible assets, so furniture, fixtures, and equipment. Amortization, intangible assets, so things like goodwill. If you purchase the business, you can write off goodwill. Now, the key word here is write-offs, because you're not actually, you've already paid for it, you're not writing a check. That expense is removed, essentially, from the expense column, increasing profitability. Non-recurring income and expenses, so if you've had a large leasehold improvements, one-time legal and administrative fees, federal grants. We see this a lot with employer, with stimulus aid, tax credits. If you had insurance proceeds come in, or if you're writing off interest. So you know, let's use an insurance claim as an example. If you had a large insurance claim come in that's not part of the business model or income related to the business model, so that income will be removed from the bottom line. If you received a grant or EIDL or, you know, now a little bit in the rearview mirror, but if you received federal aid, that's not business income. If you've spent, you know, legal fees, filing that paperwork, that is an expense that can be added back. So multiple adjustments there. We spent quite a bit of time in that category. And then discretionary spending, travel, meals, entertainment. If you're having your shareholders meeting in the Bahamas, we can probably write that up, write off that expense. You don't need to travel that far. That's not a business expense. If you're having meals, and that, again, that benefits you because you're writing off those expenses. Good from a tax standpoint, but we need to make that adjustment to realign profitability with a real figure. So net profitability is what we're taking away from this slide. And this is a, well, this is a very busy slide here, but we need to look at why profitability is the driving factor for prospective buyers in the marketplace. And we're really looking at all parties to a transaction here. So the reason, and I've summarized it here, because purchasing a business is fundamentally a business decision. So a business must have the ability to, A, service the debt related to the purchase. In the parentheses there, you see a bank walking around the table and looking at all parties involved. The bank is involved in 80% plus or minus of the transactions, commonly an SBA loan for restaurant acquisitions. So for a bank, they need to do the math and understand that this will, what they would call debt service. They have debt service coverage ratios to make sure that this is a good investment for them. So just a quick example, if a business is producing $500,000 in profitability and we've decided, hey, we're going to price it at $2.5 million, and buyer puts $500,000 down, they carry $2 million in debt. You know, in that first year, they're going to accrue current interest rates, round numbers, 10% for an SBA loan, they're going to accrue a $200,000, they're going to carry $200,000 interest payment in a business that's generating $500,000 total. So that's a large number that may mean that that this doesn't pencil for a bank, and where this can come in is where the value is not, we haven't valued the business accurately. The bank's going to look at it and say, dear buyer and seller, we're glad you're in agreement. This would be a great business. But we can only fund up to amount X, right? Let's say it's 1.5 million and then we're in the middle of a transaction. Obviously a disappointment. Generate a competitive return of rate of return on investment. So let's say we say, you know, seller says, we're not interested in dealing with the bank. We're just looking for a cash buyer. So anybody looking to invest in the business, even if they have the funds, they're going to look at investment options and opportunity cost of capital, meaning what else can they do with that money? So in that same example, somebody having the capital of $2.5 million, they're generating $500,000 and $2.5 million investment. That's a 20% return. And we'll get into rates of return later in the presentation, but they're going to look at how competitive that is, what the risk factors are. Is that a good investment of their time and money and resources? So from an owner-operator standpoint, can the business cover operating expenses and pay the owner a living wage? Right? You see that owner-operator, that's the main concern. If it's not a bank or an investor, how's an owner-operator looking at this? Is it worth their time and their effort? And then D, also, you know, an umbrella category, but also an owner-operator optic. So deliver a premium beyond the labor contribution of ownership to justify the risks of business ownership. So the business has paid the owner a living wage. Is there something beyond that, right? They may be making the same living wage working elsewhere. Is there something beyond that that incentivizes them to put their money in a business that carries certain risks? And is that an attractive sort of ratio there to incentivize investment in this business? So below, disregarding basic economic principles when pricing the business eliminates approximately 90% of the buyer pool. So we can say, hey, the heck with all of this. We're looking for, quote unquote, the right buyer. We can take that approach, but understand that you're eliminating a majority of the buyer pool when we're not being cognizant of these factors. So structure and replacement cost of ownership. I mentioned in the beginning, this is frequently overlooked. The questions that everybody party to a transaction is going to ask is, how many owners are actively involved in the business? How much do they work on average? What are their roles in the business, including any special designations? So special licenses or requiring schooling, passing tests, et cetera. Or what is the fair market labor replacement cost of ownership? So all very important questions. Below that, you see why is that important? Again, we're looking at economic and opportunity cost. A buyer buying the business needs to understand what is required of them to generate this. We'll keep going back to that figure of $500,000 in profitability. What do they need to do? Do they need to work 80 hours? Do they need to manage it executively and can be remote? What's the tax on their bandwidth and their time? And how does that compare to what they're doing now? Compatibility, you know, are they able to step into the shoes of ownership? If the owner is a master chef and the buyer is, you know, has a strong, you know, administrative and HR skill set, you know, they may need to make adjustments. They may need to hire a chef that may or may not be the best fit for their skill set. Not all profitability is created equal. So this goes back to question one, how many owners? If there are four owners taking $500,000 in profitability, that's one scenario. If there's one owner, that is a different split of profits. So understanding how many ways we're slicing the pie and what is required on behalf of ownership is important, and we'll see how that factors into the evaluation. Calculating factor A, so revenue. So how do we calculate it? So it's EBITDA, as you remember, or net profitability, whichever term we want to use there, minus the cost of ownership. And the cost of ownership is really a fair market assessment. So if you're, you know, if you're running HR in front of the house, and you're working full time as an owner, you know, we're probably looking at a general manager with an office in HR, an administrative skill set. How much would it take to hire that person in a region where the restaurant is located? You know, in King County, that number is, that's one number. In a different geographical area with maybe lower labor costs and lower cost of living, that could be a different number. So we need to be careful about assessing the contribution of ownership and where the facility is located and correlated to index it to cost of living there. So let's say it's $575,000 was the profitability. We've subtracted $75,000 as the labor contribution of ownership to arrive at that $500,000 figure. And we've called it excess earnings. So this is a number that A, is it the amount of profit generated by the business beyond the labor of the principals? Does it represent the advantage of ownership, meaning business versus a job? It's the amount that receives a multiple. And I will just tell you that, yes, it's all of the above, and running through it, the definitions here briefly. So the amount of profit generated beyond the labor contribution of ownership. So how much is the business putting off in profitability beyond what the owner needs to do, whether they choose to do that work themselves or hire it out? We need to put a number on it, cover briefly how we get there. It represents the advantage of ownership. So this is important. Again, this is what is the advantage of owning this business, assuming that just working in the business isn't the primary driving factor? How much of this business, of this company, is a business for an owner operator, and how much of it, the profitability, is a job? Receives a multiple. This is important to understand. So not all profitability receives a multiple. So that excess earnings, which is the clean profitability, is what the buying demographic will want to pay a multiple for. If 250,000 of this 500,000 was owner's labor, the buyer does not want to pay a multiple on the work that they have to do. So excess earnings, it's advantage of ownership. And that's the portion that receives a multiple once we've factored out the labor contribution of ownership. We're going to set factor A aside for time being, because we realize we need to multiply two numbers together. And we remember that factor A, we've arrived at a number of 500,000. Factor B, so the multiple itself, which is the most common question that we get, what is my multiple? So the multiple is twofold. Part one is the scale or the rate of return. So if I asked you how you felt about the event that you went to last night, typically I would say we're assuming a scale of 0 to 10. Once I give you those parameters, I can kind of gauge, I can gauge your response and have a frame of reference. So when you ask about the scale and the multiple, we need to establish how we're gauging it. Because if I said your multiple is 4, but the scale is 0 to 100, you might be disappointed. If I say it's, you know, your multiple is 2 and the scale is 0 to 3, we're probably in the range. But so let's look at how different businesses are, what scales are typically applied to some of the common business models that we see out in the field. So A, 0 to 3. So this would be a single location retail restaurant. What that 0 to 3 means is it's an expected rate of return on the high end of 33%, which means a 3-year return, 33% per year, 3 years total, which gets us to a 3X. That's a 3 multiple. B, this would be a business with a diversified revenue stream business model. So meaning we have income coming in from multiple sources. We could be doing catering. We may have dining room walk-in. We may have, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner. We may have corporate accounts. We may have a drive-through. So that business would receive a higher multiple versus just the business that is catering to walk-in business only. And so 0 to 4 yields a rate of return of 25%, which is a 4-year timeline, which is a multiple of 4X. 0 to 5. Would be a an example of that would be a multi-location chain of privately owned or franchised units. So we're talking a 20% return and 5-year timeline and 5X. And then we have a 0 to 20 for an asset class containing commercial real estate, for instance. So that's a 5% return. That's 20 years. That's 20X. So question can come up. How and why do we put certain businesses and certain asset classes, why are they rated this way? And you can see a correlation that the longer the repayment period, the lower the rate of return, the higher the multiple. So why is somebody willing to accept a 20-year repayment period for commercial real estate in King County, which is, you know, aggressive but not uncommon, versus wanting their money back in 3 years in a single location retail restaurant? So I can speak to both. And one, we do transition quite a bit of commercial real estate. My personal portfolio involves many transactions involving the sales of business and real estate. But two, it's to show the spectrum, basically. And the buyers expecting a different rate of return will be looking at these various asset classes. And you may ask me, you know, Oliver of IBA, where is this coming from? Where are you coming up with these scales? So this is prevailing market practice and what's out there right now. So buyers looking at investments in these different asset classes and sectors would be seeing other opportunities in these ranges. So high to low rate of return on the bottom. What determines the expected scale rate of return for a specific business or asset class? And it's really a one word answer to the second part of the multiple, and that's risk. So I've put here a risk spectrum, continuing on the last slide, of government bonds to Bitcoin. So, people in either of those are probably not looking at buying restaurants, but again, it does demonstrate the spectrum. Why are government bonds yielding a very low rate of return versus cryptocurrency that is, or commercial real estate that's, commercial real estate would be on the government bond side versus cryptocurrency that's more aggressive and yielding higher returns. So it's all on the spectrum of risk versus reward. Anybody investing money, whether it's into a business or into market securities, is going to look at it on a risk versus reward ratio or on that spectrum. And somewhere on that spectrum are retail restaurants, are franchise hospitality opportunities. So what sorts of things are we looking at when we're looking at when we're assigning the risk factor? So multiple range or scale is correlated to the following key risk factors. So industry, stability of the sector, revenue profile. So how stable has the industry been? COVID's in the rear view, but it's certainly still in the discussion and has put a little fear into folks. But that's a factor that we cannot change. We need to be aware of what COVID did to retail. So retail and hospitality revenue profile, very commonly, it's not recurring revenue. It is revenue made. An individual decision needs to be made, right, every time a customer comes in to purchase something. So if you're making $1 million in revenue at a $10 transaction size, that's 100,000 transaction and individual decisions that need to be made by a typical client in hospitality. So there's a certain risk associated with that. The customers have shown great propensity to do that, but it's still an individual decision versus, say, something with government contracts, right? So size of the business. Simply said, one location is riskier than five locations. If we're diversified geographically and then the number of units, it's considered a lower risk, meaning a higher multiple. And again, remember, that's buyer willing to accept the lower rate of return. Revenue diversification, multiple sources of revenue. So businesses that draw on different avenues to generate revenue are considered safer than a business relying on just one input. And staffing and operational infrastructure, what are your support systems? So, if a manager, a key employee walks away, does the business crumble? Does the profitability drop? How are our manuals? How's our equipment? Are we safe and are we resilient to keep going and maintain day-to-day operations? So quickly, subcategories of the multiple. Following additional categories are also evaluated to fine-tune the multiple for each individual business. So clarity of books and records, and this is a verifiable document trail. So we can put numbers out there and talk about our business. If we can't stand behind the facts with tax returns and clear documentation, it's going to be an uphill battle to make a case for value. So growth rate, recent performance. The buyer is the buying marketplace is buying the business that they that they're projecting into the future. Our most recent performance is the closest proxy to that. So we're looking at recent growth rate. Competitiveness, this is market reputation, word on the street, however you want to call it. Somebody looking for services and products that you're selling, how likely are they to come to you with reasonable regularity in a very competitive industry? And then an umbrella category of desirability, we're talking about location, curb appeal, website reviews, staff, role of ownership, looking at all those factors as we're determining the value of the business. And putting it all together. So this is just one valuation model. So I'm going to go through these numbers here, but just understand this is when we evaluate a business, we utilize multiple value models. But some of the concepts stay the same. It just helps us look at the value from different angles. Again, walking around the table, making sure that the things align. So we've determined, so single location, we'll use a single location retail restaurant rated on a scale of 0 to 3 for this particular example. We have determined that revenue, remember our factor A, excess earnings of 500,000, we're going to multiply that by the multiple of 2.8. So we're assuming we scored highly in all of the categories. Now, what that 2.8 means is that for every dollar that an owner earns for owning the business, meaning that 500,000, every ownership dollar is worth $2.80 at the time of sale. So multiplying those together, we get a goodwill value of 1,400,000. I talked about how we factor in fair market value of furniture, fixtures, and equipment. We've used an arbitrary number here of 200,000. We typically tend to be conservative on the fixed assets and the equipment. That's not why somebody buys a business. We'll get you fair market value, but that's not the majority of the value. And then for a total value of 1,600,000 for a business generating 500,000 in excess earnings. So below that, you see most of the value will be concentrated in goodwill. Businesses that are categorized as asset heavy are difficult, can be a difficult sell. So we need to be reasonable in the value of furniture, fixtures, and equipment outside the scope of this presentation as to how we determine that. But just the takeaway is that most of the value, we want most of the value to be concentrated in the goodwill factor. So also promised to touch on what is goodwill. It can be kind of an ephemeral concept. The other name is blue sky. That doesn't really improve it, right? We're still sort of in perceivably in woo land with the concepts, but it really is pretty concrete. So I'm going to use a quote from an owner. The concept of goodwill seems to be synonymous with profitability. Isn't there more to my business than just dollars and cents? There absolutely is. But let's look at what goodwill actually is. So business goodwill, and this is a goodwill of a going for profit concern, represents the vote of the paying customer. So people vote with their dollars. If people like your business, if you have goodwill, if you have reputation, people will come and patronize the business and become paying customers. So strength of the value proposition is what we're offering, delivering an attractive proposition to the client base. Is this something that they want to keep returning to? Is it competing? And enduring strength of the value proposition. So does it hold up? Market reputation of the business. This is something that the owners spend their blood, sweat, and tears building. Again, if we've built a good reputation, we want good online reviews. We want people to mention us with a smile. But if that doesn't equate to them coming in and supporting us as customers, then we really don't have business goodwill. And then the quality of the customer experience just brings it together. Again, this is, you know, if there's a good customer experience, people will recommend you. People will talk about you with a smile on their face. They will recommend you to friends, family. When people come in from out of town, it's really a result of all the hard work and effort. And it's sort of consummated in the general idea that I would say beyond just reputation, it's how people feel about the business. And we can have a little fun with this. Do we have time?
Yeah, I have a couple questions real quick, yeah. Oliver, if you don't mind. I love the bucket list here, right? Let's move on to our next phase of life. Yeah. Couple quick questions that I thought is, when you look at the multiple factor, are there any published guidelines? I think of myself as I have a franchise brand of 10 locations, or mm-hmm. I have a regional brand of 10 locations, right? Mm-hmm. And how does IBA support the owners that are looking to sell in that multiple and figuring the multiple out? So again, is there a published version of this of some guidelines that people might use that you can point to? And then the second portion of that would be, how does IBA support?
Sure. No, that's a good question. So we do have a separate franchise division that focuses on franchised units. And we're certainly capable of handling a multi-location chain and do so routinely. How is there a published figure? So there is no single marketplace in the United States that, on par with the, let's say, multiple listing service of residential real estate that contains all of the information of comparative market analysis. So we don't really have that to go off of. We also, on the factors that we covered, we're really focusing on the fact that each business is different. They're the same in category and in industry and in size, but there is no two identical businesses. So, the best thing to do is to undertake an evaluation and to find out where, you would be understanding, in these general categories that we've presented, in something like that, in a 10 location chain that you're probably in a 5 multiple and above, somewhere in there. From there, we are going to look at, recent performance. We are going to look at your staff. We are going to look at your footprint in the region, the variety of revenue diversification factors. Again, how risky is this? Because the safer something is, and the more reliable that profitability is, the more somebody is willing to pay for it and accept a lower rate of return, which increases the multiple. So I don't have a number figure to put on that, on that hypothetical, but we are looking at a higher multiple for a larger business.
Okay. And then as we recently have gone through, COVID with government grants and et cetera, mm-hmm. How are those been typically addressed on those businesses moving forward selling?
Yeah, so they're non-recurring revenue. They're a blessing in many cases, and they carried many businesses through. Understandably, we have to factor them out of profitability because that has stopped. So that revenue is not generated by the business model. So if we can only count on the dollars that are generated through the value proposition of the business. If you had an insurance claim, if you had government money, if you won the lottery, right, that's not part of the business model. So we will factor those out and we'll itemize them separately. We don't want that income, for instance, to be in a revenue line item or somehow impact our key ratios. So if we're not itemizing it and factoring it out, then all of a sudden our cost of goods ratio is off, our labor ratio is off because we received this profit that isn't really business profit, right? So it could be higher, it could be lower. That's part of that adjustment process where we really fine tune it to say, hey, we understand that things happen in businesses and no 2 years are alike, but here it is normalized. Here's what you can expect as a next owner operator, as a successor of this business. Here's what this opportunity represents, and here's what we've done. So the evaluation essentially answers that question.
Have you seen as in the selling aspect that the story is a little maybe shorter, more recent than including COVID? Maybe in the past, I would have the last 5 years. I would have 3 years. Has that story changed a little bit because of the differences between pre-COVID, COVID, and past COVID?
Yeah, no, and you just hit the nail on the head. So the story, in more than one way. So the story is evolving. The story of COVID is changing. I would say mostly it's in the rear view. But if we're looking at, 4 years of historical financials, or 4 to 5 years of historical financials, and we're going from 2019 to 2024, we do want to be able to tell a story that has a narrative, right? So here's the history of the business. Let's say it's 25, 30 years old. Here's 2019, here's the historical perspective. Here's what happened during COVID. We're down in 2020. We're starting to, maybe 2021 is still somewhat impacted. We're starting to recover towards the end of 2021. 2022, we're kind of back on the horse. I would say 2023 in most cases And for most businesses, really to be competitive has to be pretty strong. We need to have recovered from COVID, but we're still telling the story, right? And in most cases, it really helps us showcase the strength of the business, because a business that survived COVID and navigated it and is now back to either historical performance or better, that's a sign of resilience, right? If you survive COVID, you can probably survive, you know, any other similar event, and hopefully it doesn't happen. But the way a buyer is looking at it is, one of these just happened. The business survived. I've got a long runway of you know, prosperity with a strong business.
Thank you for that. There's a couple questions in the Q&A, so let me read those off. One of them is, another thing to add onto COVID grants, there may also be the non-recurring expenses associated with retaining grants and credits that also get removed.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the categories in the adjustments I spoke to was legal and administrative expenses. So if you received employee retention credits, but you spent, you know, thousands of dollars on an accountant or on, you know, on an advisor to do so, yes, the money that you received is not categorized as income, but the dollars you spent doing it is also not viewed as an expense. So they're both non-recurring.
Okay, thank you. Another question came up is, should a seller expect less for all cash offers?
Should they expect less? I don't know why they would expect less. Am I understanding the question correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. We look at cash at closing, whether it's delivered by a bank or by a buyer themselves, as, you know, relatively equal. I don't think we're expecting less. We're really trying to. We've taken the time to evaluate the business. We feel strongly about how we valued it and the price range. We're trying to deliver that to the client at closing. And, you know, the payment method and the delivery of funds, I would say, you know, liquid cash, buyer having the balance sheet to purchase it eliminates a bank. That's probably a little safer. If anything, it's a benefit. But generally an SBA lender will do just as good a job delivering funds. So we're not too hung up on that.
Okay. So it's not something that's pushed or something that's negotiated to keep the price. But at the end of the day, do you find a lot of cash buyers looking to reduce the price of the seller based on cash?
So it is a negotiation token, and like I said, you know, it can hedge a little bit and then cut down on the timeline and the risk factor. What we don't want to have is have that used as a tool to really reduce the value of the business beyond its fair market value. So we understand its convenience and safety factors. However, that isn't an open door to come in low, if you will. So we still want to get fair market value.
Do employer purchases change the equation? Employee purchases change the equation?
Really, every different type of buyer changes the equation somewhat. Maybe, again, not so much the fair market value. It's how we approach and structure a transaction that changes. Because really, to a seller, if we've established fair market value, in that regard, we don't care who the buyer is, and it doesn't change the number. So those two are independent. If a seller wants to make concessions, I recommend not being too attached to who my buyer needs to be. We need to have, you know, the exit prioritized, and our goal is certainly, you know, delivering every last dollar to our clients that the marketplace will support. That being said, you know, issues of transition can be easier. You know, if you've got a group of employees or a known employee, a general manager who knows the business really well, you've got, you know, open communication with employees, customers, vendors. That piece can be easier. You know, the client we value the business and we create options for the seller to choose. In the end, the business owner will always be the one making the choice. You know, as a broker, I want to put them in a position to make an informed decision. So,
okay. Couple more questions.
Yeah.
How do you calculate excess earnings for 100% owner operated business?
So 100% owner operated, what I'm sensing this means, if it's all ownership's labor, and in essence, if all of the profitability is represented by ownership's labor, there is no excess earnings. There is a different value model for that. And we sell businesses that, and absolutely represent businesses that you know, may not be putting off many dollars beyond the labor contribution of ownership. They're great owner operated businesses, but we use a different, maybe a more simpler value model for that. It can be sometimes known as a buy a job business, right? So somebody coming in is buying themselves a job. I can tell you they're not going to want to pay a large multiple for that, because it's really more of a job than a business at that point.
So if it's labor-based, it might lower the multiple.
It's labor-based and it's an owner-operated opportunity. Again, happy to look at that and evaluate. I've sold many of those myself. Seem to be some of the best transactions in terms of rapport. Different model.
Okay. And then a final question is, do you find that today's higher SBA interest rates, that 10 to 11%, negatively affecting prices paid for businesses compared to more normal of 8 to 9% rates? And then there's one more question after that. So
sure.
With the higher rates, is that negatively affecting pricing?
Yeah. So, you know, the answer is yes, there's an impact. You know, if we take fair market value as an objective, you know, number, if the buyer is borrowing and, you know, if they at a higher interest rate, they're paying more for that business and they're getting the same business at the same price point, right? So it can mess with those debt service coverage ratios. It can require a larger down payment. It can require some flexibility on the deal structure. I don't find them to be deal breakers, but a higher cost of capital does deter some buyers, makes others look at it more closely, gets people on the fence and kind of in the holding pattern. So it's just important to understand and put that in context of things.
Here's a great question. When you own the property on your business, will a seller normally receive a higher cumulative price selling the business separate from the real estate or together?
Short answer is they almost always appear better together and deliver a higher package price. You know, one of those factors is that you have to consider as a seller, if you're retaining the property, you are immediately, to some extent, partnering with the buyer. You're still involved. Let's say it's a single tenant building. You're partnered in their success. So if they're not delivering, if they're not succeeding for whatever reason, you know, you're now partnering with them as a landlord. One of the few brokerages that can sell businesses and real estate together. As I said, I do it routinely. That's why I put and we value them differently. So if you remember, the single location business is 33% return on real estate is much higher, right? We're talking 5 to 10%. So we'll value businesses and real estate independently, and we'll price the assets as a package or just as a business sale. What we typically won't do, and we'll refer this out, is just sell the real estate. So in my case, the business needs to be about 50% of the value of the transaction. Happy to still do the evaluation, look at it and recommend it from there. But yeah, but typically the answer is yes, it is more attractive to include the real estate. It attracts a higher caliber buyer. Better deal for the seller in most cases.
Okay. Final question here. Is there a spreadsheet that can help a member calculate or build their factor, right? A and B factors, and help them build that in preparation for meeting with someone like yourself, to be able to communicate, I guess, where they see those different equations that can affect the value of their business.
Yeah, and that's a great question. So meeting with somebody like myself, with a professional, meeting with broker or brokers, and evaluating your representation options is really the reason to understand where you stand on value. You don't need to do that work yourself. You know, if I asked you how many businesses have business owners sold, in most cases, the answer is zero. So, you know, the core competency of a business owner is to run the business and operate it successfully. You know, our value proposition is we allow the business owner to continue doing that while we professionally handle the transaction in the background. And the valuation, an initial meeting is a part of that
service.
So getting the business evaluated, understanding where you are now, understanding what factors are impacting value positively or negatively, what can be done. We can, you know, model changes and the timeline for a sale down the road. You know, my answer is that's really why you meet with a broker. You know, you wouldn't meet with them after having done that work yourself.
Okay. I mean, like you can, and then there's actually one more question here from the attendees is, how is the debt of EIDL balance sheet figured into the equation?
Yeah, so that's an EIDL loan. It was a federal assistance, part of the federal assistance dollars that came down the pike. EIDL loan and any other kind of debt without getting too deep into deal structure, but in an asset sale, which is most hospitality sales, the seller would be expected to retire all debt. So they would, it's a no cash, no debt transaction. So they would be keeping their cash in the bank and any receivables and cash equivalents, and they would retire all debt and really hand over a clean slate. So if you're owing money, whether that's to a credit card company or a line of credit or to the government, that would be expected to be paid off at closing. Now they've sort of loosened up the requirements, and most of that debt can be paid off with the proceeds from the sale out of escrow. So it tends to be an easier solution.
Thank you, Oliver. I think this was excellent. That is the number one question I think we get in these webinars, is the how to address the multiple factor. I've never seen anyone break it down like you did. I think you did an awesome job of doing that. That's a
Thank
lot
you.
Of information to absorb. What I'd like to do is turn it back over to Lisa. I'm sure there are some that would like to utilize this as a resource, the webinar. So with that, but I just wanted to first thank you very much with your relationship with our members.
Absolutely.
You're supporting them in their sale opportunities. You've been doing this for years in the hospitality industry and with the association members. And just want to thank you for your time and your presentation today.
I value our partnership. Thank you.
Lisa, it's all yours.
Oliver, we've got about 7 minutes left. Did you get a chance to bust your myths?
Mythbuster, yeah. So this is we can have a little fun with this with this slide. You know, there are a lot of ideas sort of that, you know, these may seem like stretches, but they do enter the equation with pretty amazing regularity sometimes. So this is more aligning expectations and making sure that we're operating on numbers and not inaccurate or incomplete information. So mythbusters about value. And so most of these fall into the pie in the sky value models or sort of emotionally driven value assessments. And let's go through them. So the bucket list model. So the bucket list model is commonly rooted in the fact that my business is worth what I need to fund the things I want to do in retirement. So there's just, you know, as business owners work and put in their time, they're building a bucket list, and the sale of the business needs to cover that. Now, so MythBuster, obviously that's not true. The fair market value is really untethered from what we need to do next. And this is no different from anything else that you're selling. There's sort of an expected fair market value, and what we need to do next is perhaps irrelevant to the market. So Silicon Valley model, you know, this is rooted in maybe the newsreel where venture capitalists have bought, you know, high tech firms with, you know, on a great idea, right? And maybe it hasn't materialized, but they want to get there first, and they're paying just exorbitant amounts of money on what the business will one day become. Sometimes that thinking pervades the mind of a business owner in the small business community, where they feel like they put some really powerful wheels in motion. They haven't materialized, but you know, boy, does someone have some potential to come in here and knock it out of the park. But we'd like to get paid for that today. MythBuster, that does not happen. We're still operating on current and historical profitability. So sunk cost model. You know, we've all made some good and bad business decisions, some poor business decisions, or things maybe not poor, they just haven't worked out, but they can be painful, and we still remember the price tags of whether that's that new location or new expensive patio that didn't attract the customer like we expected. So sometimes owners try to bundle that in, and you know, if it's not generating revenue, you know, 5 years down the line, it probably was not a good business idea. We're going to have to absorb that cost. Nothing wrong with that, but the buyer won't pay for it. So the hearsay model is what we've heard other people sell their businesses for, and you know, it's, yeah, it can be a composite of inaccurate and incomplete information that we've received from well-meaning advisors, friends, relatives through the grapevine. Such and such sold their business at this number, and so we business owners can get somewhat attached to that number, and really the answer is to get a fair market business evaluation and get the facts, because there's quite a bit riding on it. If you're you know, if the proceeds from the sale are intended to fund your retirement or the next chapter, or your next venture or adventure, get the business evaluated. The God model, good old days. So this is basing the value of the business on what the business did historically. Maybe 10, 15 years ago was the heyday, you know, and for whatever reason we've declined, but the good old days are just back around the corner, and we want to bundle that into the value. Again, we're going to look at that 3 to 5 years of profitability, most recent profitability. So I'd say the most important, and like I said, this is a fun page, but the most important thing to understand is that, you know, everything that the owner has put in, the exit value, and this is an important term, is really, it's not a reflection of the blood, sweat, and tears and the sweat equity and everything that they've put into the business. It is exactly that. It's an exit value. It's important to understand that you've taken part of that value as an annuity, as you've owned and ran the business. And this is the fair market value, which is your compensation package as you depart to enjoy the golden years or your next venture. So it pays to get the numbers. It's numbers and figures that typically sell businesses. Getting the facts through an evaluation is time well spent.
All right. Well,
and here are my contact. Here's my contact information. Lisa, I'm sure you're available to give it to anyone that's interested in having a follow-up Q&A, more questions. We do have a busy, growing team of business brokers at IBA, many of them focused on hospitality. If you're interested in exploring your exit strategy options, would love to talk to you and see if we can be of value.
Well, thank you so much, Oliver. Again, this is great information for our members. And yes, this will be up available on our website first thing tomorrow morning. The video and the presentation will be available. And if you have any questions, go ahead and send Oliver an email. And Oliver, thanks again so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for attending. Thank you, Oliver. Thanks.
Take care. Everyone have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Washington Hospitality Industry Podcast. Make sure to visit our website, wahospitality.org, where you can learn more about the restaurant and lodging industries and the Washington Hospitality Association. Be sure to subscribe to the show in iTunes, Google, Spotify, or iHeartRadio so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Thank you so much for that effort. Until next time.